Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we hear an excerpt from a past interview with J. Marvin Herndon, a geophysicist, and he discusses his theory about the Earth's core and its relationship to the Earth's magnetic field. We'll also hear an excerpt from an interview with Boyd Bushman, a retired senior research engineer who worked for Lockheed Martin Skunk Works, Texas Instruments, and Hughes Aircraft. But first, let's look at some of the stories in other news. Here's one. As stated by university researchers, government scientists, and international scientific advisors, a minimum of 57.7% of schoolgirls exposed to low-level microwave radiation are at risk of suffering stillbirth, genetically damaged children, when they give birth. Any genetic damage may pass to successive generations. Professor John R. Goldsmith, International Advisor Consultant for RF Communication Epidemiology Communication Sciences Advisor to the World Health Organization, Military and University Advisor Researcher, wrote concerning the low-level exposure of microwave irradiation below thermal level incident upon women. Of the microwave-exposed women, 47.7% had miscarriages prior to the seventh week of pregnancy. The level of irradiation incident upon women was stated as from 5 microwatts per centimeter squared. This level of irradiation may seem meaningless to a non-scientist. However, when I say that it is below what most schoolgirls will receive in a classroom of Wi-Fi transmitters from the age of approximately 5 years upwards, this level becomes more meaningful. A distinction here must be made, and a very important one. Schoolgirls are not women. Schoolgirls are children, and children are both neurologically and physiologically different from adults. A child's brain, tissue, bone marrow has different electrical conductivity properties than adults due to the higher water content. Children's absorption of microwave radiation can be 10 times higher than adults. Permanent low-level microwave exposure can induce chronic nitrosative and oxidative stress and damage the cellular mitochondria. This stress can cause irreversible mitochondrial DNA damage. This is what Amy Worthington was saying to us. I was invited to present a lecture at Brighton University recently, and one doctor commented on a plus 60% fetal birth rate damage from exposed farm animals. All mammalian species will, of course, suffer the same consequence resulting from low-level microwave irradiation. There is very little difference biologically between our embryonic cells. The article continues here. Imagine you're 5 years old in school, sitting with a Wi-Fi laptop near your abdomen. Theoretically, your ovaries can be irradiated until you leave school at age 16 to 18 years old. When you become pregnant, every one of your follicles, to become eggs, will have been microwaved. Hence, you may or may not deliver a healthy child. Should you become pregnant as a student, your embryo, for its first 100 days, if it is female, is producing approximately 400,000 follicles within its ovaries for future childbirth. The problem is that these developing follicle cells do not have the cellular protection of mature adult cells. Consequently, your grandchild may have had every single follicle cell irradiated and damaged prior to its conception. Therefore, when your child becomes an adult with irradiated follicles, there is a greater likelihood of its child, your granddaughter, suffering the ailments previously mentioned during conception, embryonic, and fetal development stages. The article continues. Here's a section, "The Very Sad Truth." I've been very honored to address approximately 40 royals, government, leaders of peoples, and government officials over the years. My address to one king concerning the numbers of ill children was placed on the internet. I referenced more than 200 cancer leukemia clusters in schools up to the time of data collection from low-level microwave transmitters in schools. There were many types of cancers, leukemias, miscarriages, and breast cancers of staff. These continue, mostly only recorded locally to this day. The Russian National Committee on Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection, in their research, document health effect on children and teenagers found an 85% increase in central nervous system disorders. 36% increase in epilepsy, 11% increase in mental retardation, 82% increase in blood immune disorders at risk to fetus. The reader may think that the cell phone irradiation is different from Wi-Fi as it has more power. In fact, Wi-Fi can be more harmful because of its low power. Low power can enter the body and cause harm. All electromagnetic waves are cumulative. If they are below the body's threshold to cause activation of the necessary proteins required to defend and repair tissues, the damage accumulates very slowly and is undetectable like a cancer. Think of sunbathing on a cloudy day. You can still burn your skin. During the Cold War conflict, while I was collating effects from microwave pulses, modulations caused by brain entrainment, resonance, both cyclotronic and circadian, rectification at the boundaries within the body, generated by electrically induced phase transition, it came to my attention that a list needed to be published for all microwave communication systems. In this open letter, I list 1 to 40 hertz pulses, modulations per second, and their corresponding neurological physiological response. For example, 30 days exposure to unmodulated 2450 megahertz microwave radiation triggered a small but significant increase in anti-brain antibodies in the blood of rats, which could then result in an autoimmune attack on the brain or nervous system. An example of an autoimmune disease is the brain in Graves' disease, in which the pituitary gland at the base of the brain is affected. That's 2450 megahertz microwave radiation. Now, if you add a pulse modulation frequency to the 2450 megahertz, then you get fatigue, depression, psychiatric problems such as anger, loss of appetite, and problems with movement can also be induced. The article continues. It's by Barry Trower. It's titled Humanity at the Brink. Here's another story related. It's on the Natural News site. Cell phone radiation fears. Canada's largest teachers union votes to turn cell phones off in the classroom. The largest teachers union in Canada, the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario, has passed a resolution requiring that cell phones in classrooms be turned off. The message behind the EFTO ruling: it's time to protect school-aged children and teachers by turning off cell phones during school time. This is no small move for the 76,000 elementary teachers from Ontario who make up the ETFO. Echoing the concerns of her coworkers, teacher Sandra Wash, who spoke at the meeting, said, "There is cause for concern for members' health and safety, especially women." The ETFO's vote is supported by information from the World Health Organization, which classifies the microwave radiation emitted from cell phones and Wi-Fi as a class 2B carcinogen, meaning that it could possibly cause cancer in humans. A second vote demanded that school boards stop hiding Wi-Fi transmitters in the ceiling and label them as part of a hazard control program. Everyone who is exposed to the microwave radiation emitted from cell phones and other wireless technologies is at risk. However, children are especially vulnerable due to a thinner skull, a smaller head, highly conductive brain tissue, and exposure at a much earlier age. A child's undeveloped nervous system and immature physical status means that they absorb more than twice the amount of radiation as an adult. Children affected by microwave radiation may suffer with ADD, nausea, vertigo, dizziness, headaches, racing heart, memory loss, and sleep disorders. But this is an incomplete list. Radiation exposures have also been linked to brain tumors, cancer, cardiovascular disease, depression, and a long list of other serious illnesses. The article continues. We go now to hear an excerpt from an interview conducted 6 years ago with retired senior research engineer Boyd Bushman. He worked for Lockheed Martin Skunk Works, Texas Instruments, and Hughes Aircraft. He was originally interviewed by David Sereda in the documentary From Here to Andromeda. I caught up with him in 2007. Let's have a listen.
I wanted to ask you about Ben Riches, the former head of Lockheed Skunk Works. comment that he made during a speech in 93 at UCLA. Mm-hmm. And he said, quote, "We already have the means to travel among the stars, but these technologies are locked up in black projects, and it would take an act of God to ever get them out to benefit humanity. Anything you can imagine, we already know how to do." Now, with this looming energy crisis and the sustained harm to the planet, what do you think anti-gravity has been kept from the public sector, or has it?
Let's see. Let me think of how to approach this. First of all, anti-gravity, the item, does exist. All you have to do is, in fact, go over to your astronomers, as I have. If you take a look at gravity, in spite of the fact that when you rise, when I rise in the morning, I say if the sun's rising and I'm vertical, I won. Okay? However, I look down and I see that little Australian down there. And he's looking at me and he says, "You did not stand up, you stood down." And I looked at him and I said, "No, you're the one that is standing down." And we begin discussing what is gravity. Well, okay, gravity is a very, very small force until you get something the size of, you know, the moon or something. And all of a sudden gravity becomes large, gets the size of the Earth, and it's okay. But we stand all the way around like porcupine quills, okay? If you have a teaspoon full of dirt, gravity's nothing. If you have a moon, gravity's something. If you have a sun, gravity's pretty darn good, you know. Okay, but if Sir Isaac Newton were to be alive now, and he were to take a look at Einstein's theory of relativity, you know, 1 over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, he would immediately say, well, let's subject that to the mathematical forms that I kept sacred. Every college calculus book has a thing called a series expansion, and it comes from Isaac Newton. And all it is anytime you have a couple of terms, you can expand it in a series expansion. If you take the Einstein theory of expansion, you all of a sudden take it out, expand it out, and the first term turns out to be 1. Well, if you multiply it times mc squared, I'm multiplying all the terms to m0c squared, then it says energy is equal to mc squared. That's Einstein. Okay? Mm-hmm. The second term, after you multiply it with mc squared, has c in the denominator, and, you know, down in the basement. It cancels the c, and you get 1/2 mv squared. That's kinetic energy. If you multiply m0c squared times the third term, and fourth term, and fifth term, and sixth term, and seventh term, nevertheless, they turn out to be the electric force, the magnetic force, the weak force of the down in the atom. You know, the thing that's holding, and then the strong force. The strong force holds neutrons and protons together. Okay, but the series also shows 3 additional forces. Well, the next force after the weak force turns out, gravity is in that series. In fact, the gravitational constant is in that series and accurate to a gnat's eyebrow. The key item is that it shows that there are 3 forces beyond the strong force that's holding the atom together, the nucleus together. Okay, we've already seen that if I go from a teaspoon full of dirt all the way to the sun, that gravity becomes significant. Well, all of a sudden, if you even go larger to the galaxy, the next force kicks in, which is anti-gravity. And we have looked at the galaxies, and they are being pushed apart by anti-gravity, and we will become lonely one of these days because the galaxies are all leaving each other. Is that interesting?
That is interesting.
Well, but the thing that's interesting to me is, where is F 6, 7, and 8? The forces beyond anti-gravity. They're real, and using the expansion, we can see their characteristics, and we have yet to name those. Not only that, but if you take the equations of light, all of a sudden the sun's up there and it's bright. Well, how does the sunlight dim as it comes toward the Earth? Well, it dims according to R squared. Okay. It literally decreases as you go away from the sun.
Right.
In fact, if you will go between Mars and Jupiter, there is a point at which the average temperature in space is freezing. And that is exactly where the asteroid belt is. And the majority of them are frozen hunks of ice. That interesting?
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's
true.
The asteroid belt corresponds with the...
0 degrees centigrade.
Now, getting back to this alternative source of energy that's mm-hmm. possible for...
But see, there are three that we have yet to name. And we're trying to work with them. We're trying to bring them around so that we can use them. The light of the energy of the sun decreases as R squared. But do notice that a laser violates that law. A laser does not decrease. Okay? So if I all of a sudden had G in laser format, it would not decrease with R squared. And if I had anti-gravity in laser format, it would not decrease as R squared, right? If I approach maybe something that works on your question. In other words, if you can actually find the force, there's many ways you can apply them. Thompson and others had already worked over there. They had about three items that worked quite well. And not only that, historically, there have been several devices that have floated in air quite well.
How would you describe one of those devices?
I won't.
Boyd, you know, sky watching, photographing the sky, and oftentimes we photograph objects that are not planes, they're not helicopters, they're not satellites. Some mm-hmm. are disc-shaped, mm-hmm. and some are spherical. It's likely, I suspect, these craft are using anti-gravity. Is this technology available to, like, private corporations such as
Lockheed? Well, the real question is, do they have a stamp called the United States Air Force on their side? I also have those data sets. I have all the videotapes of Bob Lazar's TV stuff. Mm. And I have all of the work of Cyril in World War II, where he basically was making UFOs fly using magnetism.
Okay.
And I have all the work from Canada, where he built a device and it took off as it glowed. I guess the real question is I think you stated it very well. It says, can we apply some of this stuff? And then your next question is have we applied some of this stuff?
Yeah.
Now, I tried to answer that question by saying, how come Cyril had magnetism? And how come the people up in Canada had magnetism? Maybe anti-gravity is a cousin to magnetism. And so I went back to Galileo. Galileo wandered up the Leaning Tower of Pisa and dropped two rocks, right?
Right.
Okay. So I took two fairly powerful magnets, not electromagnets, but regular magnets. When you bring two magnets close together, they go clunk, right? But if I take them apart and turn one around and try to bring them together, they don't want to come together. So I drove a brass bolt between them and tightened them down and then did an iron filing test and found that magnets that are about an inch and a half in diameter, I was getting north lines would come out of one magnet and look at the other magnet, which would also be a north, and it would take a right turn and go way out and then come back down and into the south. And I found that I had a flux of about 6 feet off, kind of like a tabletop.
Wow.
Monopole material around my magnets that were tied together. So I tied them together and I put them in a configuration and it looked like a rock. Well, anyhow, something looked like it. And I built another one that just had some non-ferric metal in it. And I weighed them and they weighed identical. Now, Galileo's weighed different. Mine weighed identical. And I went up to the Leaning Tower of Building 500 inside the Lockheed Empire. And I had 9 observers down at the bottom. And I said, okay, I'm going to drop 2 items. If one of them lands first, put it in your hand. And I assigned one of the guys to be the chief observer down there. And then I'll come down on the elevator, and you hand it to me. Okay, so I did that, 9 times. And every time they handed me the one that did not have the opposing magnets in it. I said, how much sooner did this land than the other one? And he said, it hit, bounced, and was about to hit again when the other one came. Now, that's a lot of time.
Yeah.
Okay. So, evidently, there is a way of tying into that good stuff. G did slow down with using a cousin. And needless to say, I've progressed on from there. But that's about as far as I can go. An interesting guy who has 2 degrees, including a medical degree and a degree in physics and other few things. And he's a little bit more liberal than most. And for a fee of about $15,000, he gets a whole group of people around, and he all of a sudden uses acoustics and a few other things. And all of a sudden, all of the clouds form in shapes like flying saucers.
How do you think he does this?
Very well, thank you. Well, that's a real guy, and that he indeed does reproduce. Well, I said clouds form. To him, he believes he's calling UFOs in, okay? He actually believes that.
Oh, wow.
Well, I've already told you that I follow the data, theory be damned, okay? Well, there's data kind sets number 1, 2, 3, and 4. Data, primary data, is one where I actually observe it myself, and I have my instruments and equipment confirm to me what's happening. That's primary data, okay? We'd all agree on that. Well, okay, when I actually get down to stuff like you're getting, I basically have to calibrate the people and then see if I can get repeating data from several sources that don't know each other, and they have no financial axe to grind or anything like that. Then I basically can start compiling data sets. Well, I compiled data sets like you, and then all of a sudden I ran across one particular guy that kind of blew my mind. He did say he was coming back from he was a medical profession for the Navy way back in, his career. He's still alive, but he doesn't let me use his name. Nevertheless, he was indeed working on pilots because of various diseases and things and operations. He was a surgeon. Now, at any rate, there was one particular pilot that began to talk. I don't know if it's because he had painkiller or whatever. And nevertheless, he began to talk. And he said, okay, Boyd, I want to tell you this because this guy is true blue and the story is real. And it's about time that it got out. So I said, okay. Now, I take notes on anything. And he said, one day they received a radar sighting. And so they asked him, the pilot he was operating on, to head up there to investigate the radar sighting. So he went up there, and he kind of saw a kind of a silvery thing in front of him, kind of going back and forth and back and forth. And so he was closing in on it, and he was currently flying the best thing that they then had. I mean, the fastest airplane that did exist in the inventory of the United States. Okay. He called back, and he says, okay, I see it, and it's in front of me, and it's going back and forth. I would like to know from you guys, are there any friendlies around? Are there any other airplanes or anything that's flying in the sky that is one of us? they searched and came back and says, no, there are no friendlies. And he said, okay. And he says, now it's starting to move a little bit faster than me, and I have the fastest airplane that exists. Therefore, request authorization to shoot it down. They talked among themselves, and they said, is it still there? Says, yeah, it is. Says, well, you have the latest weapon we have. Go on ahead. Shoot it down. He did, and it came down, a silvery-looking thing. Actually crashed. There was a roadway along the side of it, and he came and landed and went over. By the time he got over, one of the whatever was out walking around, and he went inside.
You mean occupants?
Uh-huh. He went inside, and he found three of them that he basically had annihilated. I mean, his own weapon had done that.
Is this the Roswell?
Yes. Okay. Anyhow, only because the guy has no vested interest at all, and it is confirmed on every one of the side little innuendos of what it may have been is confirmed by this report. In my den here, I have to think, is my wife here or not? No, she's gone. So it's my laboratory. Well, yeah, she calls it my den.
Uh-huh.
But I can get to 10 million. I can get to a million volts three different ways in 10 minutes inside this room. Okay. Therefore, I have been in the process of trying to apply voltage to the center of a counterclockwise motion, moving item. And I've been successful in small scale. Now I'm headed toward a larger scale. And if I actually feed that with voltage, it should grow, if the atmospheric conditions are right, grow to be a tornado. I would prefer that it be a waterspout, of course, and I have a large lake next to me. And so if there aren't people out boating around, I may carry this on. I am a senior scientist in charge of death and destruction. I worked in TI in the days where we produced the laser-guided bomb, you know, F-16s and F-35 and F-22. We just got all that working. And you talked about the advanced programs. Well, there's one that they didn't complete. In fact, two that they didn't complete. Do you realize that the atomic airplane was totally designed? I have pictures of it and of the nuclear pile that was flown. Mm. Anyhow, you know, wouldn't have to land. Is that okay? You look at the atmosphere. If you look at the atmosphere, the light molecules rise, right? And the heavy molecules kind of settle down. So if you look at the lightest of the molecule is hydrogen. Well, if I were to create an airplane, and I wanted to really create an advanced airplane, I would probably go up in altitude using a standard jet. And then I would switch it over to a pulse jet, you know, to a buzz bomb, because at higher altitudes you can do that. And then I would all of a sudden scoop my fuel up. I would scoop up hydrogen.
And then I would
go and skip off of the Earth's atmosphere like a rock across the lake. Not only that, but the description of the contrail, at least when I got to phase two, would look much different, and therefore the reports you've been seeing. Isn't that interesting? I did go back with you to the weather patterns back to 5,000 years BC. I said that the Earth could survive quite well. I didn't know about us, how well we would survive. But yeah, when we go up or down in temperature, you expect our atmosphere to respond in like ways, which is okay. But the Earth can do pretty well. There are particular questions that many people consider to be difficult. I made them simple by asking only one question, and that is there life after birth? Scientifically, I studied that question for 3 years, and I found that there wasn't enough data. This is including me too, you know. So after a while, I found that when dogs are born, they don't open their eyes for 3 weeks. Their eyes, literally, the eyelid stays closed for 3 weeks after birth, and then they open their eyes. Well, I actually think that it's probably 18 years or so for the human. And then all of a sudden he figures out why he was created and what he was to do in life. And all of a sudden he starts coming alive a little. Okay? And when people are following their own destiny, the only thing that I know is that they can't ask anyone else, because anyone else can just say, this is my destiny. Now, I can also say that, therefore, people do come alive, and some of them earlier than later, and some people never make it. But at any rate, well, you'd concur with that. There is an inbuilt thing. But again, the lemmings jump off cliffs, too.
That was retired senior research engineer Boyd Bushman. We'll be right back after this break. Go now to an interview with J. Marvin Herndon, a geophysicist who discusses his theory about the Earth's core and its relationship to the Earth's magnetic field, the shield that protects our planet's animal and plant life from the sun's radiation. Dr. Herndon published an article titled "The Corruption of Science" in Dot Connector magazine and relays disturbing evidence of how the National Science Foundation, and other institutional structures have created an oppressed environment for scientists affecting the free exchange of ideas. His article examines how to rid the scientific field in the United States of charlatans, science barbarians, and create an environment so the truth can flourish and scientists can work freely without fear of retribution or denouncement for challenging ideas or failing to adopt the politically correct consensus-approved storyline. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Your article, titled "The Corruption of Science" in the latest Dot Connector magazine, is very amazing, very impressive. It's a feature article. And what prompted you to write this article?
Well, I was very well trained as a young man in science. And I learned science from the masters who learned it from masters themselves. And so I had a good sense of what science is all about. Science is about truth, discovering the true nature of the Earth and universe. But it didn't take me long to find out that there was something bad wrong with science, that people don't tell the truth. And moreover, the system encourages and rewards people who are deceitful and the institutions they serve. And eventually I came to understand how that is. The civilian science wasn't supported in the U.S. very much before World War II. And after World War II, the effort was made to give science a financial support so that it would benefit humanity, benefit people, benefit the economy. And the National Science Foundation was established in 1951 to do that. And when they set up the mechanism, they made mistakes. They set up a way of funding science that brought out the worst in people. And they've been using that, and other agencies inherited this. So for half a century, the U.S. government has been corrupting science. I mean, look, if you want a support for science, you write a proposal to the National Science Foundation, for example. You must say what you want to do, how you want to do it. It has to fit into the bureaucrat's program. And then they send it out to review to your competitors, secret reviews. So people who are competing for the same funds get to say whatever they want to about your proposal, and it's taken as fact.
And you don't even know what they're saying.
They usually will give you a little summary of a few little excerpts, but no, generally you don't know what they're saying. There's really no appeal. You can appeal to the program manager's boss or something. People protect themselves.
If you really land on something very important, challenges some fundamental scientific ideas, you also mentioned that then you could be blacklisted.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, here's what happened. The idea of secret reviews was taken up with all the government agencies. It was taken up with virtually all of the scientific publishers. Hey, a great idea. We'll have your competitors review it in secret. What happened was that scientific papers were taking years to get published, if they were published at all. People don't want their competitors to get credit for something. They might end up getting funding that you should have. So this was getting to be a deplorable state. And so the National Science Foundation in the 1990s did one thing that potentially was brilliant. They funded the development of an author self-posting archive, a computer program where a scientist, when he had a preprint of a paper, even before submitting it to a journal, would post it with this computer, and it would be all over the world for all of his scientific colleagues to see. It was brilliant, without human intervention.
Wow,
but
that's
it
great.
Didn't take long before the developers of that process began human intervention and began blacklisting. And around 2001, this was developed at Los Alamos National Laboratory. And around 2001, the developers, in some sort of a coordinated effort with Cornell University, moved to Cornell. The National Science Foundation gave Cornell University almost $1 million to take over the ownership of that author self-posting archive. And they took it over and began seriously blacklisting people who were selected. I mean, generally, people, hundreds of thousands of papers have been posted on this archive without any human intervention at all. But if somebody contacts the administrators, an insider, and for whatever reason, they want you to be singled out, you're singled out for disparate treatment, the papers you try to post, either they don't post, or they're buried somewhere where your competitors can't even see them or aren't likely to find them. And even if they contradict work that Cornell University is receiving federal funds to conduct, you have to ask yourself, what's wrong with this picture? An institution can operate a system that hides scientific developments.
Let's go back to what you were mentioning about scientific truth is not an opinion.
Oh, it's really not. You can understand, you can make measurements, but that's if you do science well. Science should really flourish and function in a community where there's open discussion and debate. If a person publishes some scientific results, then they should be challenged, or they should be confirmed. They shouldn't be buried.
What is the consequence of these secret reviews?
The consequence is this. In order to to be able to make a living doing science, you can't offend anyone. You can't contradict anyone, or they're apt to cut you off at the knees with secret reviews. So the consequence of that has been that people don't challenge existing work. They don't challenge work that's been supported by a government agency, NASA or National Science Foundation. This consensus conformity has taken over science. People are afraid. I mean, it's just like in a totalitarian regime. I mean, when you have secret police in a totalitarian regime, nobody wants to stand out. They'll be singled out for persecution. So you just chant the same chants that everybody else does. And this is what's happened in science. And that's not what science is about at all. Science is about finding out what's wrong with present thinking and correcting it. And this is carried over into textbooks, into schools. And young people are being taught science that's not really science. Much of what they've taught is not correct. But it's sort of the consensus-approved story. And people aren't learning in schools that, hey, you should be challenging science. You should be asking, what's wrong with this? And that's the consequence. That's the serious consequence.
The students of science don't even know the right questions to ask.
They're doing a lot of things that aren't real science at all, like making models based upon assumptions instead of making discoveries. They aren't questioning what's put before them. That's what science is really about. It's about asking, hey, what's wrong with this picture?
I mentioned in the introduction that there was an interesting report in 2009 by Jennifer Washburn, and you probably know about it, Big Oil Goes to College, and examined how ExxonMobil, Chevron, Royal Dutch Shell, and other energy companies have forged multi-year, multi-million-dollar alliances with top universities and scientists to carry out energy-related research. I think that's another example of how scientific direction is being shaped to conform to a particular model.
Any financial input causes this to happen. You saw the whole climate gate debacle with global warming.
Right.
Because people were all on the bandwagon of getting funds to show that global warming is taking place. And boy, the people that said, hey, you know, you're not taking into account changes in the sun or changes in the Earth's energy output. And those people's work was being buried. This has gotten to be a system that is so badly broken that I think that it's virtually beyond repair in its present state. It's a sad state of affairs because this ultimately affects what people learn in schools. It's just part of a bigger picture, a bigger problem of corruption in the business community. It seems to me that we're living at a time when people who are law enforcement officers turn their back, close their eyes, and they don't see and will not listen to allegations of corruption. For example, in June of 2008, I wrote the Attorney General for the state of New York, Andrew M. Cuomo, and requested a formal investigation of allegations of blacklisting, unlawful restraint of trade, and violation of individual civil liberties by the management of the author self-posting archive, arxiv.org. That's what we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The university library and the provost of Cornell University. Andrew M. Cuomo, Attorney General for the state of New York, did nothing. I never heard back from them.
Wow.
It's okay to cheat taxpayers, and this is what it all gets down to. You hide and you bury and you suppress work that contradicts work that taxpayers are paying for. This has the net consequence of cheating taxpayers. It's a serious matter because it's not just me. A lot of people, I don't know exactly how many, who have made statements that they are being blacklisted.
Well, this it is critical. And your work, can you describe to listeners some of the scientific theory that you've come up with about the Earth's core and why that's really important right now?
Yes, I have come up with a number of things. One of them, and this goes back like 20 years, I realized that the ingredients were all there for a naturally occurring nuclear reactor at the center of the Earth. And over time, I've shown that this is the best understood method for the production of the Earth's magnetic field. Now, before, people had thought that this was generated in the Earth's fluid core, which is, you know, makes up a mass of about one-third of our planet. In the georeactor, the nuclear reactor at the center of the Earth, it's only 1/10,000,000th the mass of the fluid core. So what that means is that changes can take place very rapidly. And along the way, I've shown that the convection that's necessary to produce a magnetic field, mistakes were made, and it can't happen in the Earth's fluid core, not for long periods of time like has been observed for the magnetic field. And so what we're looking at is the possibility of very, very rapid changes in the Earth's magnetic field. And so to bury advances along those lines, because this affects everybody. I mean, if the Earth's magnetic field were to undergo a reversal or to shut down, I mean, we would be bombarded with an incredible solar wind. It would fry the electronics of satellites. It would induce currents into any long conductor, whether it's railroad tracks or power lines.
Mm-hmm.
Create charges that could reach staggering potentials on surfaces and sharp points, cause electrocutions and fire, just fry the satellites completely.
We're speaking with Dr. Marvin Herndon. He has written an article titled The Corruption of Science in Dot Connector magazine. Very fascinating. But you write about implications that I've never heard of an event like this. Can you continue to describe that?
Well, I will, but let me suggest that there's a link for this paper, as well as a lot of my other work,
mm-hmm.
on the website nuclearplanet.com.
Nuclearplanet.com.
Yes, nuclearplanet.com. It's easy to find this particular article. If you scroll down on the home page, you'll find a picture of me with a piece of blue tape over my mouth.
I saw that.
Suppression of science.
Right.
But so this is serious business. The U.S. government should be interested in real science, not suppressing new ideas. See, real scientists aren't afraid of new ideas because new ideas beget more new ideas, and advances are made. It's the science barbarians who try to hide things, the charlatans, the people who try to cheat and steal, and it's ultimately stealing from taxpayers. Since most of the science is supported by the government.
If you have a good scientific model that you point this out in your article, if you have a good scientific model, then newer ideas would easily plug into those models.
When you're on the right track in science, things fall into place naturally. Now, I was just talking about the idea of a nuclear reactor at the center of the Earth.
Right.
Well, very early on, I realized that the helium that's coming out of the Earth is the first solid evidence for the existence of a reactor. Over the past, 10 years or so, there's been a very large experiment being done in Japan and in Italy measuring antineutrinos that come from radioactive decay. These things are such tiny particles, they can literally fly through the Earth. They're hard to detect. Well, only in the last month or so, they came out with a new report, and it's a report that gives strong evidence for the existence of the georeactor. Some 20 terawatts of energy that they estimated from their measurements. Depending on how they calculated it, either 15% or 26% could be attributed to the georeactor. When you're on the right track, things just fall into place naturally. When you're deceiving people and you're deceiving yourself, then you can't make advances. It's like being in a blind alley. You just can't go anywhere. So that's the reason that the truth is so important, because everything in the world is connected logically to something else. I mean, things just don't exist isolated. They're connected to other things. And if you are following correctly the connections, the logical path of connections, you'll be led to more discoveries, to new observations, and to new insights. And this is what science should be all about. It's not about hiding things and cheating people.
Could you continue in your description of the possible pole shift event and the consequences?
Yes. If you understand a little bit about the way a transformer works, a transformer only works if the current, the electrical current, is changing. If you were to put a battery across a transformer, you'd see one spike on the other side of the transformer when you connected the battery and another spike when you disconnected. Magnetic induction is related to the change in the magnetic field or the current. What happens is if the Earth had no magnetic field and it was a very uniform stream of charged particles passing by, there would be nothing being induced into the georeactor at the center of the Earth. But you do have a magnetic device there. It's almost like a transformer. It makes its magnetic field. And so changes in the solar wind, the charged particles, will induce currents down into the center of the Earth. And these can destabilize the stable convection that takes place to create the magnetic field. And so when the magnetic field collapses, then these raging fluxes, I mean, we're talking about an ionized charged particles with an effective temperature of 1,000,000 degrees cruising right through the Earth. Normally, the magnetic field deflects it and sweeps it around and past the Earth. But when that magnetic field fails, then charged particles can come in. And you see a little bit in the northern lights when you have a solar storm that sort of overwhelms the Earth's magnetic field a little bit, then you see the effect of the charged particles in the aurora borealis, or in the southern aurora australis, these incredible colors streaming through the sky. If the magnetic field didn't exist, you would see these things all the way down to the equator. You'd see the effects of the damage. It would damage electric wires because it would induce currents in it. It would be acting like a generator and induce large currents in power lines. And we know that's the case because occasionally during a solar storm, currents are induced in power lines and they'll take out transformers and electric power grids. So, I mean, this is a known quantity. And that's only when the magnetic field is only slightly overwhelmed.
Oh, I see. And sometimes, is there a breach in the magnetic field that the solar rays can sort of dip into and affect the Earth?
When you have a solar storm, when you get a more intense burst, can get down into the upper atmosphere. What you're seeing there is nothing like you'd see if we had no magnetic field at all.
I understand. Now, your research into the Earth's core and the relationship to the Earth's magnetic field, you've pointed out that there's, within the iron core, there's another core made up of several elements that allow for the nuclear fission to occur.
If you were to go halfway to the center of the Earth, you'd come to a fluid core, basically an iron-sulfur alloy. Liquid. Around the center of the Earth, you'd find a solid object that's a little bit smaller than the moon and about three times as massive, called the inner core. That was discovered in 1936, and I have good reason to think it's made of silicon and nickel. At the very center of that is a concentration of uranium and fission products, nuclear waste. And that is what is called the georeactor. It's a subcore of uranium that's undergoing chain reactions, and it's surrounded by a fluid shell of nuclear waste. This isn't a very big thing. It might be 24 kilometers in diameter, which is just, minuscule from the standpoint of the size of the Earth. You could think of it as the nuclear heart of the Earth, and that's where the geomagnetic field is produced.
Gotcha. Okay. And in the article, you pointed out stars are hydrogen bombs held together by gravity?
Yes. That's a good analogy. I mean, when a hydrogen bomb detonates, it just explodes and goes completely outward. But a star, you think about it, it's essentially the same kind of reactions that take place in a hydrogen bomb. That's where very light elements fuse together. And when they do, they produce a great deal of energy. And every hydrogen bomb is ignited by a nuclear fission atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because the thermonuclear fusion reactions, those light elements combining, they require temperatures on the order of 1,000,000 degrees to get the nuclei close enough together so that they react.
Dr. Marvin Herndon, a geophysicist. His website is nuclearplanet.com. Thank you very much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. See you next week, Monday, 10 p.m.